Motherhood's really hard. See, Mom, you hit the jackpot. Wasn't that bad, was it? So I was thinking about what to share this morning, what we would want to open up the scripture and talk about today. And we've been working through the book of Romans, and so I thought, well, it's Mother's Day, so maybe we'll detour from where we were going. But then I realized if we make a detour for every holiday, we will be in the book of Romans for the next 13 years. Because we're already well on our way. So we're actually going to be in Romans 12. But as the sovereignty of God would have it, this particular section, Paul is talking about how we love one another, relate to one another. And Mother's Day seems like a very appropriate time to talk about that. So we're going to be in Romans chapter 12 eventually in the next few minutes. But maybe some of you will know this, maybe some of you won't. At Center Church, we have an identity statement. It's three phrases. We'll take a straw poll and see if we can get it off the cuff. Does anybody know what the first one is? No. Did you say me? Oh, nope. Nope. Good guess, though. That was our series title. The first one is Jesus-centered, relationally focused, gospel-compelled. We said, okay, if we can come up with a statement that will encompass everything we hope to represent, and that was what we came up with, those three things, Jesus-centered, relationally focused, and gospel compelled. And every aspect of that can be found in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 14 through 21. And I just want to read two verses out of that section for you, verses 14 and 15. This is what Paul wrote to the church at Corinth, which if you're familiar with the book, you know that they were a mess like us, probably even worse. So this is what he said. He said, "For the love of Christ controls us." The word for controls, the Greek word that's translated, is the same word that's also translated compels. So it doesn't really imply like puts us in handcuffs and drags us this direction. It moves us. The love of Christ compels us because we have concluded this, that one has died for all, and therefore all have died. And he died for all so that those who live might no longer live for themselves, but live for him who for their sake died and raised. Jesus is the unifying factor in this church, in this community, in the Spokane, the greater Spokane church, in the global church, in the global church throughout history. Jesus is the unifying factor. It's not ever style. It's not ever a particular theological persuasion. It's not even geographical. I mean, you drove here from all over Spokane County to be here, maybe some even farther than that. Jesus is the unifying factor. His substitutionary death for all of us, the debt he paid for each of us, it compels us to the same thing. We are compelled by the love of Christ to live for Christ. Jesus is the unifier. He's in the middle of all that. We're not required to live for him, but we're compelled to live for him because of God's love demonstrated through Christ. So whether you've been in church your whole life, always, you were on the Bible quiz team maybe when you were in junior high, or maybe God saved you from a lifetime of drug addiction, or maybe, like by the glazed over look some of you have, maybe you're high right now. Whatever the case, whatever God has saved you from, Jesus saves us all from the same broken condition. He's made us into a people. We're compelled by the same thing. We're compelled to the same thing. He's made us into a community, a family, a body. He's made us into a people. And that's why the second piece of our identity statement is relationally focused. And I held up my three fingers. I almost held up the middle one because that's relationally focused. And we would have found out just how much of a family we actually are right there. But because Jesus is the unifier, because he's brought us all from scattered places into one place, we're a family. We're a body. And Paul uses those terms over and over and over. So we'll come back to this idea of being the body. But today what I want to answer in the next few minutes is a question from Romans chapter 12. When we're compelled to no longer live for ourselves, but to live for Christ, what does that look like? How does that take shape in our lives? I think we probably all have a lot of ideas about what a good Christian looks like. We all maybe have a mental picture of that. But what does Paul say in Romans 12 that looks like? That's what I want to talk about a little bit today. Quite often, we'll have a tendency to maybe answer that question just based on what we think is a good idea, what we think it might look like, and not consult the scriptures. But the problem is then we all end up with a different idea, right? Jesus ends up looking like whatever the sum total of our thoughts might be, instead of what he has actually said that he looks like. And so we all have different ideals in our lives, and then without looking into the scripture, Jesus ends up just being the sum total of our individual ideals, specifically the ones that we can actually uphold, which for me isn't very many of them. But Paul gives us a good look at this in Romans 12. So I just want to look at a few of them. We won't exhaust all of these different things, but something important to remember before we read it is, you remember last week we were at the beginning of Romans 12, and we said that all of these prescriptions Paul is about to make for how we should live, they are a reasonable response to what God has done. We don't do them to gain his favor. We simply respond in a natural, reasonable way. So this is what it says. Chapter 12, verse 9 is where we're at today. Paul says, love must be sincere. Hate what is evil. Cling to what is good. Be devoted to one another with brotherly love and honor one another above yourselves. Love must be sincere, honor each other, love with brotherly love, be devoted to one another. When we love and honor one another, there's an inherent devotion, right? And it is exhibited right here on this front row. When we love someone, devotion flows from that. When we honor each other, devotion flows from that. There's a natural connection between those two. Now, Paul says, don't just love and honor and be devoted, but do it sincerely. And I think in the context of our church culture, in our part of the world, in our day and age, the sincerity part is the trickier part. I think it's a real stumbling block for Christians in our world. The lack of sincerity is something that outsiders commonly hold against insiders. Non-Christians commonly have an issue with that in terms of how they view Christians. Because what they'll say is, Christians are hypocrites, right? We've all heard that. Oh, thank you so much. You are just, you're amazing. You don't even need Romans 12. You've already got it figured out. Here's what's offensive about hypocrisy. I say this all the time. Everybody's a hypocrite. When people say Christians are hypocrites, well, it's because they're hypocrites. Everybody's a hypocrite. We're all hypocrites. I have yet to meet a person who lives up to every single ideal that they have all of the time, whether they're a Christian or not. Everybody's a hypocrite. Being a hypocrite isn't what's offensive. What's offensive about hypocrisy is if I'm hypocritical about something and I'm either oblivious to it or I put up a front to sort of deny my own hypocrisy. That's what's offensive. Being a hypocrite isn't offensive. That's why Jesus is so awesome, because he knows you're a hypocrite, but he forgives you anyway. But the lack of sincerity in our hypocrisy is offensive. When someone has a hypocrisy happening in their life, but they're honest about it and they're repentant about it, that's not offensive in the least. When they seek forgiveness and they seek change, that's not offensive. But in order for us to walk in this brotherly love, honor, and devotion, sincerity is a necessary ingredient. It can't be done without sincerity. Without sincerity, you could be in church, this one or any other, every single Sunday for the next 30 years and be at your small group every single Thursday evening and at Bible study every Tuesday morning for the rest of your life and have absolutely no impact without sincerity. If it's all exterior, if it's all a front. This is the reason that we have a relational focus. That we've said, of all the things we can do, one third of the most important thing is to have a relational focus, to be in relationship with each other, not just passersby. Here's a verse that might be familiar to some of you from Hebrews chapter 10. The author says, Let us consider how to stir one another up to love and to good works. Do not neglect meeting together, as some are in the habit of doing, but encourage one another. This is why, as a church, we're so ferociously committed to the idea of being in relationships. Because he says, stir one another up to love and good works, and commit to meeting together for encouragement. If the church doesn't commit to those things, where else is that going to happen? Flavius is going to go to work at REI this afternoon. I'm guessing you're not meeting together to stir one another up to love and good works and for encouragement. REI is awesome, but it's not that awesome. I'm guessing your workplace is probably awesome, but not that awesome. It's not the place you go to be stirred to love and good works. It's the place you go to meet a need in your life. Now, here's the thing that's interesting about that. You may have experienced times in your workplace where you are stirring each other towards love and good works. Has anybody ever had that experience where you just had a group that you were with and it was actually an encouraging environment? Yeah, several of you. But guess what? The reason that was happening was because you had a relationship with other Christians, not because of your job. Because you were doing this. You were relationally focused. That's why you were finding it there. And Paul's saying, that's the job of the church. That's not anyone else's job in our society. It's the job of the body of Christ, which includes moms and dads and brothers and sisters and spiritual moms and dads and brothers and sisters. That's our role in each other's lives. The place where that gets met is in the context of relationship. Verse 12 says, be joyful in hope, patient in affliction, faithful in prayer. This is kind of more of an internal thing that happens, more in the privacy of our own lives. So I'm not really going to stop there. I just want to give you like a drive-by encouraging. Be this person. Joyful in hope, patient in affliction, faithful in prayer. That sounds like the kind of person that we all want to be mentored by. That sounds like the kind of person that most of us probably hope that we can mature into. Be this person. That is a life verse. If there was ever one worthy of putting on your coffee cup, that is certainly got to be on the list. Verse 13 is another prescription, another instruction. He says, share with God's people who are in need and practice hospitality. When we started Center Church, before there was ever a Sunday morning gathering or a building or a website, before there was anything like tangible to say we exist, we had a document, and it was called our launch plan. Which in retrospect was maybe a little more epic sounding than what it actually is. But in that launch plan, as we called it, there are 7 core values listed in there. And one of those core values is generosity. And what we said was, we hope to be the kind of people who desire to be not just giving, like financially giving, but to have generous hearts. So that when I see someone in need, my default reaction is to want to help them, not if nobody else is going to do it, right? We say we want to cultivate an environment that because God has been generous to us, because he's given to us generously his love and everything else we have in our lives, we want to be open-handed with those things. We want to cultivate that type of a heart. Essentially, we said, let's be people who are free from the bondage of just hoarding everything up for ourselves. Let's be people who are just free from that so that we can look for ways to bless others. Let's be generous. Let's be generous because we want to be a generous people. Generosity is a high value for us. And Paul says, share with God's people who are in need, practice hospitality. You don't have to have a lot to be a generous person, is what I want to say about that. It's not necessarily just about money, because he uses the example of hospitality. You don't have to have a lot to be hospitable. What you have to have is a desire to reach out to others, just a desire to help other people. That's a generous heart. A hospitable heart is a generous heart. Without even giving something financially or materially, just being generous enough to open up the doors and invite other people into your world is generosity. Paul says, be a generous people. And it's a great reflection because we all know people who are stingy and we know people who are generous. And one of those people is a much more accurate reflection of Christ. One of those people is also someone we'd like to be mentored by. So I just want to read through the last few verses and then we'll get to the big idea because I really just have one point that I just want to talk about briefly before we go. This is what verse 14 says. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse them. Rejoice with those who rejoice and mourn with those who mourn. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be proud, but associate with the lowly. Do not be conceited. I want to tell you a story, a really sad story, that will make you feel very sorry for me. As I was going through college, Brandy and I were married when I started college, and I realized we just need a little platform. Maybe you're good, Pastor Rick, but I'm like this much too short. Everybody's like looking around the person in front of them. Brandy and I were married when I started college, and on the way through college, I worked full time, and we had three kids along the way. And all of our kids, by the time I got to my senior year, all of our kids were under age 5. So Brandy was stay at home mom, like full time, three kids, and so we were a single income family. And it was just for me, man, it was just an exhausting season of life. So many of you totally get that as well. That's not the part that's going to make you feel sad for me. So many of you are like, whatever. So I know a lot of you can relate to that. It was a tiring season of life. So my senior year of college, I did entirely without ever setting foot in a classroom. I did independent studies. I did a few online classes, those kinds of things. Which works really well when you're a theology major, because basically what you do is you read thousands of pages and then report on what you read. Hopefully, if you're a dentist, you'll actually go and practice instead of just read about it. But that worked out well for me. So I didn't have time to attend class because of work and family, all that. So I did it by extension. And then when I got to the end, I actually wasn't able to attend my graduation either, just because of our life stage So Brandy and I moved right around the time of graduation to a new house. So I had my diploma. I had it sent in the mail to my parents' house. I couldn't go to the graduation, but I watched it on video after the fact. It looked to me like the thousands of people who were filling the football stadium were having a pretty good time. It looked like it was pretty fun. I graduated in a class of about 8,000. It's a fairly pretty big school. All kinds of people, right? Some of them were like 21 years old, bright-eyed, had the world just by the horns, and some of them were older, had kind of similar circumstance to me. Some of them, like me, were first-generation college grads and just a variety of people, but they looked like they were having fun. The friends and family in the crowd, the commencement was like 5 hours long because there's so many people, so towards the end it wasn't as fun, but Glenn Beck was the commencement speaker. If you know Glenn Beck, he's from the Fox News channel, and that was kind of cool. He was really funny. It looked really fun. But here's how I got my diploma. Brandy and I had moved out of town, and we were meeting my parents halfway because they were going to watch our kids for a few days. And so my dad came, and he handed me this large envelope, not knowing what was in it. It was unopened. He didn't know what was in it. So I sat down, and I opened it up at an Arby's in Ellensburg, Washington. I slid it out to see what it was, looked at it, put it back in, and then I packed a roast beef sandwich in my face. That was how I received my college diploma. Not nearly as fun as what I saw the other people who were actually there doing. Now, here's the part that's going to make you sad. That's not my point to make you sad. I did not have a feeling of elation when I got that diploma. I actually had the feeling of a pretty significant letdown because I was basically the only person aware of what was happening when I took that out. And my point is this. It says something about our human nature. Because when something great happens in your life, when you've worked really hard to get to a mountaintop and you succeeded, or just something really awesome happens that you didn't work for, you don't want to celebrate alone. You don't want to celebrate in the privacy of your own mind. Or when something devastating happens in your life, you don't want to bear the weight of that alone. It's in our nature. It's how God made us to need each other. We want to be with the people we love when great things happen, We need to be with the people we love when difficult things happen. When something great happens in your life, we don't want to be alone. We want to celebrate with the people who were there for the journey. And my experience at Arby's was a testament to that. It just came out of me naturally. So here's the question. How will we love sincerely? How will we honor people? How will we show our devotion? How will we celebrate and mourn together? How will we demonstrate humility? How will we do those things privately? It's a logical impossibility. The things that Paul is prescribing to us right here, they can only be done in the context of a relationship. When Paul says, this is the reasonable response to what Christ has done for you, all of the things he says there, with a few exceptions, most of the things he says there can only be done in the context of relationships with other people. What some of us will do when life isn't going as planned is we'll go into our shell. We go into our own space. Now, that probably has something to do with personality. Some are more introverted. Some are more extroverted. Some are in the middle. But Paul's saying, when we understand what Christ has done for us, it matures in the context of relationships. That's how we put it into practice. That's how we put it into action. We simply can't have this reasonable response to the gospel without each other. We can't be a body without each other. Now, I know that you all know that because you're here. But it's very easy in our culture. Our friend Dr. Jerry says that America has gone from a front porch culture to a back patio culture. And we put up 6-foot fences around our lives. And my encouragement to you is, let the love of Christ knock those fences down in your life. You're not designed to be alone. So I just want to close out with some Center Church business along those lines. Pastor Rick mentioned that Scott and Emily were here day one. Before there ever was a Center Church, they were vested and committed to us because of the relationships that they had. And I just want to talk a little bit of Center Church business, because we are at a point where, as a church family, we need to take a next step. We need to expand our influence and really share what God has done in our lives. So there's some things that we do really well, like our music is awesome. Thank you guys, as always. There's some things that we do really well. There's some things that we're working really hard to get better at, and there's some things that we just plain suck at. Most of the things we're really bad at aren't really, like, biblical. They're just, like, American cultural things that people expect you to do at church. So, you know, whatever. But I just want to talk about something that we're working hard to get better at. And I'm really, really confident that if we band together, we can be awesome at this. We can do it really, really well. So here's the chronological stages of the life of Center Church. The first stage was me and Pastor Rick sitting at a coffee shop in Puyallup, Washington, and having a few other conversations. And it only existed in the confines of our minds and our conversation. And then we got our wives on board, so boom, doubled the church. Yeah, we're awesome. That was amazing. Overnight. Plus, we have kids, so like exponential, right? Then it went from there to about 35 people who, before we ever really started doing things, they said, okay, we'll be a part of this. We'll be committed to this process. And then from there, at about the end of 2013, there was about 75 of us. Like, if we could actually get everyone, adults and kids, all in one place at one time, there would have been about 75 of us. And then a few months later, we continued to trend this upward trend to where if we could actually get all of us in one place at one time, there would have been about 100 of us. That was about a year ago. And so we made this steady trend to that point, and then we went doink. And we went doink, 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 like just kept bumping up against this barrier in our effectiveness. And right now, the influence of Center Church is limited to the number of people that a certain number of leaders can connect to. We haven't been strong relationally on every level. Right now, there's a handful of people who are really, really good at making relational connections, but we bump up against that lid where we get to their max capacity. We just bump up against that repeatedly. Those leaders can only attach to so many people. That's that's just going to be reality, an obvious one. So what's happening is there's never a shortage of people coming in, but there's sort of a phenomenon that happens in all churches in our culture that you'd think only in a big church could you go and not be known, right? Just slip in, be part of the crowd, and then slip out and not be known. But that actually can happen in a church this size as well. In fact, some of you actually have that feeling. Some of you carry the weight of being here but not being known. That can happen pretty much anywhere. And the reason is we're struggling with those connections because we have this ideal of being relationally focused. We understand the value of it, but we're like that wobbly toddler. We're learning how to put that into practice, how to make that actually work, make that a priority in all of our lives. So I just want to acknowledge that so that we're not the offensive type of hypocrite who just puts up the facade in front of their weaknesses. But we say, you know what? We can get better at this. We can get better at this for the sake of the gospel and for the good of the people who need it. Because you know what? We might be weak in some areas, but guess what? In our weakness, God looks really strong. Because he's greater than the things that we are not strong at. His greatness overshadows our flaws. Through his life, his death, his resurrection, he's made us into a body, a family. And really the big idea that I just want to point out from all of this is that we're created to be a community. We're created to be in relationships. And if we don't engage each other in relationships, we can't become mature disciples of Christ. Because the things that Paul just listed in those few verses we read can't be done by myself. They only happen in the context of relationships. We can't accomplish the things he's listed outside of the context of community. We can't find the encouragement and the companionship that makes life really rich without sincere relationships. So in the body, every part matters. In the body, in your physical body, every part grows together. That's the way the body works, and that's why Paul uses the analogy of the body. In the body of Christ, the more we love sincerely, and the more we show each other honor, the more we bless others, and the more we celebrate together, and the more we mourn together, and the more we demonstrate humility, the more we do those things, the more beautiful our story becomes. The more that we do those things, the more rich our lives will be. The more we do those things, the more powerful our testimony will be to people on the outside. I want to encourage you to seek out Christian community. Not everybody is loud and outgoing. I'm not saying that. But you know what? Sometimes for me it means I need to open the door and let other people in. But sometimes it also means I just need to open the door and go out. I just need to accept someone else's invitation. Because quite often, it's fairly easy for me to invite other people into my world, just personality-wise. It's a lot harder for me to go into someone else's when someone else engages me. Pastor Rick is working really hard to rewire our community groups, and he's doing a great job. And you know what? We know that's a system. The most important thing is for us to have a disposition that says we value Christian community as individuals. The system is a gateway. It's creating a tool. If you need to take action in this area of engaging Christian community, if you're just honest with yourself enough to say, okay, this is something I could do better about. I could be more intentional in how I engage other people. I want to encourage you to take action. If talking to Pastor Rick is something that can help you in that, great, do that. You can go to our website. There's a community tab on there where he's put a form that you can fill out that comes to him, or you can email him. But whatever you do, maybe it's just, I know there's somebody at my work who's a Christian and we need to encourage each other more. It could be anything. Whatever you do, don't do nothing. That's my encouragement to you. And here's why. Last thing. When we say no to Christian community, we're not saying no to a small group. We're not saying no to a barbecue or a book club when we hold Christian community at arm's length. What we're really saying no to is growing in our faith. Because as you read through the New Testament, discipleship happens in the context of relationships. It starts with Jesus and his crew. That's how we grow. all the way through the end to the end of the Bible. That's how we grow, the context of community. So when we say no to that and we hold it at arm's length, we're saying no to growing in our relationship to the Lord, not just in our relationship to other people. Pastor Rick, I felt like I was really negative about all that, so I'm going to ask Pastor Rick to come say something fun. But let me give you the bottom line. I pray continually that our love for one another will point other people towards Jesus, and it'll make him look awesome because he is. So Pastor Rick, come on up here, and thank you guys. Love you.